Welcome to Blog Talk Radio in high fidelity.
Henry, is that you?
Yes, I'm here. Hi.
Ah, I just told your friend we're almost ready to go on.
All right, great.
How do you pronounce your last name? Geddes?
We say Geddes.
Geddes. Yeah. Geddes. How do you pronounce it?
I would say like lettuce. Geddes.
Geddes. Am I pronouncing it correctly? Geddes. You got it. Okay. Now, the first question I always ask is a little bit about your personal background.
Okay.
Then I'll talk about your product, ask you about your product and how you came to it. Is that a plan?
Okay. That sounds like a good plan.
Oh, boy. Says we're on already.
Okay, good.
Okay. We're here with Henry Geddes. He's here to talk about a fabulous new product that I'm using. Well, Henry, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We always ask our guests one question. Tell us a little bit about yourself personally before we talk about anything else.
All right, Don. Well, I was born in South Africa, and I moved to Manhattan in the late 90s, where I studied photography. And at the time, you know, photography could be in different categories, either photojournalism. Some people are drawn to it because of the technical aspects. They love the cameras and the aperture and so forth. And what really drew me to photography was the fashion and portrait photography. And so I specialized in fashion photography and portraiture, which led me to then open a production studio, which I opened in Manhattan. And we serve customers such as Macy's, JCPenney's, Nike, Victoria's Secret, and we help produce their shoots. And then I opened up a satellite studio in Miami, which really catered to those shoots that happen in the winter. So all those brands that I just mentioned, they shoot their summer catalogs in sunny Miami for the fall collection. So that's the basic background of my photographic career.
Do you still have the studios?
I do, yes, I do.
Oh, so in other words, you have the best of both worlds. You do fashion, and other types of shoots, which I've always found fascinating. And you have a product, and I'm going to let you describe what your product is. I'm using it, but I want you to tell our audience about it.
Okay, so. You know, when you're trying to connect with someone via Skype, FaceTime, Facebook Live, etc., and the person on the other side or yourself looks kind of dark, blurry, or grainy. So we at Chatlight make lights that attach to your desktop, tablet, or any other screen that are specifically designed for video chats and live streams. So what the Chatlight is a small portable light designed by myself, a photographer, to properly illuminate oneself to look clear, bright, and better online. So we were fortunate enough to have a successful Kickstarter campaign about a year ago, which allowed us to bring this product to light.
Well, let's make it clear, because our audience can't see what you're talking about, but basically it's about 4 inches wide, 4 or 5 inches wide, has a very bright, intense light, and it clips onto your screen, and it provides very intense light. And the best part about it is it plugs into your computer as well. I've used it on numerous occasions, and I found it so terrific. I had to have you on the program.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, you know, this whole thing began when I was, I was living in New York, and in 2003, Skype was launched. And as you know, at the time, Skype was pretty revolutionary. And suddenly, you know, we were able to do a face-to-face talk with friends and family, you know, all over the world. It was unbelievable. But the problem, from my sort of photographer's perspective, was the person just doesn't look bright enough, you know. And so the obvious thing for me was, listen, why don't you turn your computer around and face a big bright window? That's the first cure. But what if you, like most people, you don't have that option? So you're in an office type, or you happen to be chatting at night. So, you know, I had the benefit of understanding. I could take a studio light, put up the umbrella, and boom, solution found. However, most people don't know how to deal with that kind of problem. And so that's sort of the seeds that started this whole idea for me to sort of, let's bring to market an affordable solution, you know, that anyone can just sort of clip on their computer or on their laptop and look way better than they would otherwise.
Well, I know that people have told me that. But the next question is, how did you source your product?
How did I source the product?
Mm-hmm.
So one of our partners has a company called Muzik, which is an audio headphone company, and that is it's sort of smart audio connectivity. And so we had the ability to tap into his resources for design and manufacture, which was really fortunate. Mm-hmm.
Well, where do you manufacture the product?
The product is manufactured out of China. We'd love to manufacture it here, but it's just really, in order for us to bring the price down, it's really hard to find someone who could do it competitively, for sure.
Okay, but let's talk about price. What is the price of your product?
Okay, so the price is $29.99, and you can buy the product via a couple of ways, primarily through our website, or you can go to Amazon.com. Most people have an account there. And thirdly, there's a gift, a very good site called The Grommet. And so all three locations are you can buy the product online.
Okay. And you say you had a Kickstarter campaign. What made you decide to go that way, and how did it work? People always hear about Kickstarter, but tell us how you decided to do it, et cetera.
All right. So it's a good question, Don, because I think that the invention or Kickstarter and other crowdfunding sites are really just another revolutionary development, because now you could literally test your idea and start a company through the World Wide Web, people out there who can back your product. So essentially, you come up with an idea or a product, or a book, a video game, whatever, and you put it on the Kickstarter platform, which has, you know, millions of users. People can sort through and see what ideas are out there, and if they like them, they back them. And in return for backing a project, could be anything from $5 to $50, they get what is called a reward. So let's say you back a normal company, you might get equity in the company. On a Kickstarter campaign, you don't get equity, you get a reward, and usually that's maybe the product itself. So in our case, we said, listen, give us $25 or $30, and hopefully we'll get enough money that we could do a first run of manufacturing. And in return, if we hit the target, we'll send you 1, 2, or 3 chat lights. And so it's really a fantastic way of raising some money, number one. And I think more importantly, these things are a test to see if the market is willing to pay money for your product. And so we were thrilled with the result. And I highly recommend it to anyone who has an idea. You know, put it into action. Just try it out. It's not easy to do. There's a lot of competition, but it's certainly worth a test.
Well, that's true. I was told you also have to provide your own list to Kickstarter in order to put your product up. Is that true?
Sorry, you said I have to provide my own what?
List of potential investors as well as using their list.
No, you don't. It's actually it's very sort of it's very neutral that way. They just say, look, show us your idea, and you've got to present it online. You have to sort of make a promotional video, have a story about how the product solves a problem, pictures, specs, and it's really a campaign to say, please support this, bring this product to life, and you're appealing to anyone out there.
Mm-hmm. And were you oversubscribed to your target or not?
Yeah, we looked to raise $50,000, and we ended up just short of $60,000. So we ended up with over 1,000 backers, which is another benefit of Kickstarter, for example, is that so before you even launch your product, you now have 1,000 customers. And so that's a great way of building your base. You get real honest feedback, and you can go back to your customers and say, hey, look, if you like the first one, we have now a version 2 or a version 3. You've got a built-in base, which is good to build off.
Well, now let me ask you the question. Do you have a follow-on product in mind?
Yeah, well, you know, we have a version 2 and 3, which is going to be incorporating a smart technology whereby the light itself will have adjustable features to it. So where now we have the light can go on, it's got a medium and a high setting. Versions 2 would have a slider, so you can vary the amount of light you want yourself. And the second feature will be where there's light comes in various color temperatures. So, you know, sunset, sunrise is very orange, warm light. And whereas midday is very white light, it's pure white. And so what we have found that one of the challenges is to really get the right temperature, the right color of light for everybody's skin tone. And so we plan to put in a feature where you can adjust the temperature. So if you have a darker skin, you might benefit from a whiter, more bright light. And if you have a paler skin, you might benefit from having the color temperature being slightly warmer. So that's pretty exciting. And I think that what people missed with the first chat light is that this is a consumer product that people can talk to each other via Skype, etc. But there's a blind spot in communications today where people in business commerce are using the product for interviewing, for example. Mm-hmm. They're using the product for consulting. They're using video chat communications for teaching and education, as well as you've seen Facebook Live now. If you've looked at your, let's say you have a Facebook feed, you'll notice how much of the feed is video oriented. So we feel like the general communication, both personally and in business, is becoming more and more and more video based. And so let's just take, for example, so we do, someone has a hiring company, the recruitment company, and what they do for customers is they pre-vet, pre-hire, pre-select candidates. And one of the big things is to make the right connection between people. And so my thought is, wouldn't it be a competitive advantage to have an optimal video chat experience where you can see a person very, very clearly and read a person's body language? Because a lot of communication is in visual cues, that if you're not in front of them face to face or via video chat, you may miss a whole lot of stuff. And so I think there's an advantage to use this video chat in so many facets of business. Why not look as best as you can?
You're absolutely right. Now, having said all that, obviously you're an entrepreneur with your own studio, et cetera. What have you learned over the years as an entrepreneur that you would pass on to other people?
You know, what I've learned is that there's a couple of challenges in doing anything entrepreneurial. You know, it goes back to the, you know, one of the words I use is resistance. I think a lot of people have some internal resistance. You've heard of the writer who doesn't write, or like the painter who doesn't paint, or the entrepreneur who never starts a venture but always talks about this. And so the inner resistance, you've got to sort of just crack that and take the step. For just to use the Kickstarter example, what is scary about Kickstarter or starting a venture or opening up your own coffee shop is that the public won't respond positively, and you know, you deemed a failure. And so I think the breaking the resistance and just taking that step and the second step and just moving forward with it is critical. And I think the second thing is getting people's attention. In today's market, it is just so hard for people to stop a second, take notice, and process what you're doing, and then buy. So whether they're going to pay for your consulting and pay for your product, you need to get their attention. And it's such a daunting task nowadays. How do you even do it? And I think it leaves a lot of people paralyzed in trying to work this out. So I would say to people, really, like, you know, read as much as you can, educate yourself, and keep current. You know, don't be lazy. Like, read and break through that morass of noise that's out there, and sort of get people's attention, and, you know, push forward for sure. And then and I think that one of the things that I found challenging, and I would look to people to think carefully about, is what category are you in? And really look at that carefully and say, look, am I in a space that has potential? Because it's so difficult to stand out that you need to be in a space where if you're going to put in the energy to do something, it's got to be worthwhile at the end. And so, you know, between really trying to say, am I going to enjoy this, because it's going to be a lot of work, and is there an upside, is there scale to this, you know, pay attention to that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's terrific. Tell us again the name of your product and where people can get it.
All right, Don. So it's chatlight.com, chatlight.com, chatlight.com.
Okay. And again, it's a very fascinating product, and we're so glad you came. I'm enjoying using it. You sent me a sample, and I have to tell you, it just works terrifically. Thank you for being with us, and have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Likewise. Take care.
Our next guest is Andrew Hay. He's a CISO of Data Gravity, and we're going to talk about a lot of different things. But Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We're going to get into details about security, et cetera. But tell us a little bit about your background, because you have a fascinating background that I want our audience to know a little bit about.
Sure. So I've been the CISO at Data Gravity now for the past, coming up on a year. So I'm responsible for all of the internal security and the external and product security as well. And so prior to that, I ran the research team at OpenDNS, which was acquired by Cisco a little more than a year ago, probably a year and a half ago, I guess the acquisition officially went through. Before that, I was at Cloud Passage, doing a lot of cloud security evangelism and research. And before that, I was an industry analyst for a few years at 451 Research. I worked in the information security office at a university in Western Canada. I lived and worked at a bank in Bermuda, working in the information security office. And going back to the very beginning, I think I first got my start in IT by doing dial-up tech support for users that were calling in from Tennessee. Rural, very rural Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had a fascinating career. That's a relatively new title, CISO. Would you explain that a little bit before we go any further? Because I found it puzzling at the beginning until I figured it out.
Sure. So it stands for Chief Information Security Officer. And the role, it's an executive role within quite a few companies now. Sometimes it is listed as CSO, where it's Chief Security Officer. Sometimes you'll see a CTO with VP of Security. But the main role of a CISO is to represent the security concerns of the organization and make sure that the company, the organization, all of the divisions are unified in the security vision for the company and for the servicing of the customers. So just like a CTO is responsible for all of the technology, the CISO is responsible for all of the security across the company.
And why is it becoming more and more important in this world to have such a role for a company?
Well, I'd say probably 10, 15 years ago, it wasn't viewed to be an important role. But as security concerns really started to gain press attention and require further scrutiny, organizations realized, or at least individuals within organizations realized, that having a non-executive security leader wasn't as effective as having someone with a seat in the executive, at the executive table, because it's all well and good to have a business that exists to make money and service customers. But if part of that is disrupted by lack of security or a security incident, then someone needs to be able to handle that and, mitigate it and prevent it from happening again in the future.
Well, how do you deal with that? How does your company deal with that? You're on this program because you're one of the few experts I've run across that is articulate as you are. Tell us a little bit more, because I know our audience just judging from the emails I've gotten about this subject, are really interested in what you have to say.
Sure. So what's interesting is I would say that there is a very defined difference between someone who is acting in this chief information security role for a non-product company, so like a non-security vendor, or a non-vendor in general, because in a typical organization, let's just say a Fortune 2000 company, the individual rarely, if ever, has input or any sort of product function within the company. Their role is exclusively defining, designing, and implementing security for the organization, but also measuring its effectiveness, communicating that effectiveness to the executive team, and just making sure that all the checks and balances are balanced. Whereas in a software startup or a security company, you wear, just like in any startup, you wear as many hats as your head can really hold. And so I'm doing the internal security, but also influencing and helping define product direction, making sure that what we are designing and messaging is something that a person like me would be interested in buying if I was in one of those other companies. So I'm, I get a lot of questions from my peers saying, hey, would a CISO, would this resonate with a CISO? Would this feature be something that someone in your position would pay for to secure their organization? So it's a role where I have to put myself on both sides of the table, and it's really interesting to do that just dynamically and kind of switching it around from time to time.
And what does your company do now?
So we're a security software provider, and our entire company exists to help people identify and protect their sensitive data. So if you think of all of the files that you may have lying around that have personally identifiable information like your name, address, social security number, credit card number, and then multiply that by exponential values, that's what the average organization that handles customer information has to protect. And not only do they have to protect it, but they have to first identify it. So what we have is a software product that allows you to discover where all of these sensitive files are located, what type of information is stored within that sensitive data, and then show you who's accessing it and with what frequency they're accessing it.
Wow. That's really interesting. That to me is very interesting. Please continue. Do you think that these threats are going to expand over time?
Yeah, they're definitely going to expand over time. As long as personal information has a tangible financial value associated with it, combined with the ease at which someone can acquire that information from a compromised company and then sell it, it's going to keep evolving, and it's no longer just individuals that are doing it from their parents' basement. That is not the typical profile of an attacker of this nature. that's trying to get this personal information. It's loosely organized or even, you know, formally organized criminal enterprises that are doing this as a business. They are compromising hospitals, financial services organizations, and trying to get as much information as possible that they can take and sell on the, you know, the quote-unquote underground market or dark web, like it's being referred to recently or lately. And those all have tangible financial gains associated with them. So it's going to keep getting more organized, and it's going to expand considerably.
Well, okay. What are some of the things small businesses or any business should be doing to protect themselves besides working with your company and other companies?
Well, so the first thing that... Sorry, go ahead. So I was going to say that the first thing I always recommend to people, and this comes back to my days of working at a bank, working at a university, and it's being, you know, you have to become data aware. You need to understand where your sensitive information is located before you can protect it. Because it's, you know, if you think about building a castle, the first thing is not going to be, all right, I'm going to build a wall and then decide later on, okay, well, that wasn't the best place for my castle, but I've got this wall, so I'll just leave that there and I'll build my castle, you know, 3 miles down the road. That's not how you build it. You build your central castle first, and then you build the protections around it. And, you know, we've been doing that for hundreds of years, but when we think from a computer security and data security perspective, we're often trying to bolt on additional security countermeasures before we even understand what it is we're trying to protect. So if you have a better sense of what you're trying to protect, the value of that information, then you can protect it accordingly.
That's great advice. I haven't thought of that way. Can you go on? Can you give us another one?
Sure. Yeah, I'm full of analogies.
Well, believe me, we have the time for this because this is such a critical issue for small businesses.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, if you think, so I, you know, I'm Canadian. I came here and living in San Francisco now. And one of the things that I had to go through was the entire green card process after I had my work permit approved and everything. But what I kept having to send information, so fill out all of these forms, put pretty much every piece of information that could ever be used to easily steal my identity, scan my my passport and all the pages, scan my driver's license, send my marriage certificate, you name it, send all of that along via email to a law firm. So once I send that information to them, I have no guarantees that they are protecting the data in a way that I would feel confident, but it's that's just the nature of how we conduct business. And small businesses really take that into account as well. You know, they're dealing with a number of, if you think of something, an organization as small as a small corner store, where a small mom and pop shop, let's say, where there's maybe two people that own it and operate it, they have a number of partners and distributors that they have to deal with. And the information that they're sharing with them may be could be quite sensitive, all the way from customer names and transactions for credit cards or debit cards to order numbers, and even giving that vendor or supplier of food products, giving them your corporate credit card number or account numbers. So all of this information is being strewn over the internet and between multiple parties. But as soon as you let go, it's kind of like a letter or a postcard. Actually, a postcard is probably a much better analogy. The postcard, once you put a postcard in the mail, you have no control over who has the ability to read the note that you've written on the postcard, because it's available to be read by anyone along the way. You don't know the qualifications or the security rigor invested by the Postal Service or any carriers along the way. You're just implicitly trusting that it is going to get from point A to point B within the given time frame, and that nothing is going to be altered or stolen or copied along the way. And that's how a lot of people treat security, especially SMBs. They're, a small, medium business is, in most cases, they're trying just to stay operational, generate revenue, make sure that they can pay their employees, pay their bills. And when something like protecting secure data or sensitive data comes up, it's often thought of as a, hey, this isn't really, this isn't why I'm in business. I may not pay attention to that, or I may not have the spare time or cycles or money to invest in understanding and protecting that. But that really is a big concern, especially when there are financial penalties and sometimes criminal penalties, depending on the state that you're in, associated with the theft of your customer data. Because you may be on the hook for something as simple as credit monitoring that you'd have to pay for a year, or it could be a class action lawsuit from all of your customers saying, hey, all of our information that we shared with you was stolen, and now you're going to pay you're going to pay out the nose for our time and the pain that we may have incurred. So that could be devastating to a small business. So the investment in security is a cost of doing business that has to start being thought of by every size of business, not just the Fortune 2000.
Yes, very definitely. The name of your company again, and how people can reach you and it?
Sure. So the company is Data Gravity, and you can learn about our product, read about just security in general, if you go to www.datagravity.com.
Will you spell it out?
We're also datagravity.com.
And if they wanted to talk to you?
If you want to talk to me, the best way is to find me on Twitter. It's just Andrew S.M. Hay, H-A-Y.
Okay, you were going to say you also have
me.
Right, but I interrupted you. I was going to say you also have something else.
Oh, we also have a blog that we update very frequently with security tips and tricks and security news and our takes on things. So that blog can be found off of the main datagravity.com webpage.
Kevin, you've got to come. Andrew, you've got to come back and talk some more.
Yeah, happy to.
It's been fascinating. It scares me to death each time I hear someone like you, because we're a small company too. But we wish you a happy Thanksgiving, And we definitely are going to have you come back.
Yeah. Happy to.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye.
Our next guest is Kevin O'Connor. He's Vice President of Marketing for Neopost USA. And he's talking about a subject that's dear to the heart of small business, how to improve delivery efforts. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Don, thank you so much. Good morning, everyone out there in the audience today.
Well, Kevin, we always ask our guests first, give us a little bit of your personal background before we do anything else.
Sure. Thanks, Don. Kevin O'Connor, again, I work at Neopost USA. My current role here at Neopost USA is the Vice President of Marketing with a particular focus on our mailroom solutions business. Like I said, I've been here for 7 years at Neopost USA and 20 years overall in the mailing and shipping industry.
Okay. Well, that's not about – okay. But a question I always have, what is Neopost USA? It's a great name, but what do you do?
Yeah, Neopost USA is a provider of both hardware and software solution to mailers and shippers of all sizes. We primarily sell our products and solutions to businesses, and as businesses engage in communications with their customers, which could be businesses or consumers, we try to provide them, again, hardware, software solutions that help them communicate through mail, through shipping solutions, and through digital communications with the solutions that we provide.
Well, that's good, a lot of solutions, but do you work with helping them better deliver their products, better pull in the information? What do you do? And how can you improve what is going to be a hectic period for the next 4 weeks or 5 weeks?
Yeah, sure, Don. Thank you. You know, our major partner is the United States Postal Service. So we provide solutions that help customers prepare mailing and shipping documents and parcels sent through the USPS, as well as some of the other carriers from a shipping perspective. And our solutions are really designed to help customers prepare both the contents of those mailing and shipping documents and parcels they're sending to their end users. So we help customers prepare those documents, add some data integrity, fold, insert the contents into those shipments and envelopes, and then provide a very cost-effective way to find the best rates to apply to those mailing and shipping output.
Well, give us an example of how you can make a smaller company more profitable in terms of fulfillment.
Yeah, good example, Don. You know, especially this time of year, as a lot of small businesses look to ship products to their customers, we provide our customers shipping solutions, or really shipping software, that allows customers to easily create shipping labels and look for the most cost-effective rates and delivery methods to be able to ship parcels to their customers the most, again, cost-effective, productive, and efficient way to make sure that they're getting those packages delivered to their customers within the time frames.
Well, you know, if you've got 20 SKUs and you're a small company and you've got hundreds of customers, how do you sort it out to make it more efficient? Do you do it by size? Do you do it by weight? What are some of the ways a person could do a better job?
Yeah, it's really a variety of ways, a couple that you already mentioned, Don. When businesses ship packages to their consumers, they need to think about, you know, the size of the package, the volume of the package, the weight of the package, you know, the dimensions of the package, obviously, the geographic region to which they're shipping the package, and then also the delivery time frame by which they want to have that package shipped to the customer. All those factors go into the way that the carriers calculate the rates And using tools like the solutions that we provide help businesses, help small businesses figure out the most economical and effective way to ship packages to customers.
Well, can the small businesses get discounts from the post office for having X number of packages? Or is that something? I've always been fascinated by the U.S. Postal Service's many different rate schedules depending on what you are and who you are.
Yes. And typically, Don, if a small business were to go to a retail counter at the USPS, they may pay full retail rates. If you use one of the solutions provided by NeoPost USA, that small business can actually take advantage of some of the commercial rates, discounted rates that we can provide to shippers.
Well, what is it? Is it 100 parcels a month? Is there what's the minimum someone should start looking at a solution like you provide?
There's really no minimum. Not only do our solutions provide the most cost-effective way to get the best shipping rates, but there's also a lot of additional features like the tracking capabilities that we can provide in partnership with the carriers, some of the insurance capabilities provided by the carriers. So there's some additional benefits above and beyond just the cost savings perspective. Many of these shipping solutions tools offered by companies like NeoPost USA are very inexpensive. Could be as low as $5 or $10 a month to take advantage of all those services I just mentioned, including the commercial rates.
Really? Well, like in our business this week, in the next 6 weeks, we'll put out like 120 packages to various things. The year-end packages, et cetera, to people. Is that a good break-even point for us to start, us being information strategy to look at a NeoPost solution?
Oh, absolutely, Don. And actually, we offer solutions for shippers of all sizes in terms of volumes. But the type of volume you just described, we have perfect solutions that really help you maximize the productivity and efficiency as you prepare those packages, and really maximize the potential for cost savings versus what you'd pay at full retail rates at the counter. So that type of volume is perfect for one of our solutions. And like I mentioned earlier, certain even lower volume shippers that send out a handful of packages every week are also good for some of the solutions that we provide.
Well, what are some of the questions you ask a new potential customer when they come to you and say, I'm looking for a shipping solution?
It really boils down to a handful of questions. One, as we've just talked about, what is their shipping volume? Second is, what type of charges are they paying today for their shipping services? What types of challenges do they have in their shipping operations? Is it more about productivity? Is it more about cost savings? Is it more about delivery timeframes? Is it more about, data quality? Things like that are the types of questions that we would, ask our customers or our targets when we talk about some of our shipping solutions. We're really there to help consult customers in terms of what options are available to them from both a mailing and a shipping perspective. In particular, this time of year, which can be both a fun and stressful time of year when you think about small businesses sending packages to their consumers. So it's really about just providing flexible solutions, cost-effective solutions, and asking customers or small businesses those key questions that I just mentioned and really help them, maximize their shipping operations over the next few weeks.
That's really interesting. What are the three things you tell shippers to keep in mind in a period like this?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question?
What are the three things you tell shippers that they should really keep in mind when they go about creating a program?
Yeah, I would say the three things. Number one would be, first, educate yourself on all the shipping options out there. There's a lot of resources online that can be easily located both on our website or directly on the courier's websites. So I would say number one, just educate yourselves on the on the options that are out there. Number two is really understand, when small businesses are shipping packages, all the different options in terms of dimensional weights, size, delivery dates, geographic zones. Really understand, where and how they're shipping their packages. And then number three is really what's the needs of their end users. There are a lot of extra services provided at no additional cost from the carriers that can really add value to small businesses when they provide this service of shipping products to their end users in terms of delivery time frames, tracking services, et cetera.
Again, the name of your website and how people can reach you or anybody in your organization?
Sure. Our corporate website is www.neopostusa.com. We also have a dedicated shipping website, www.neopostshippingsolutions.com. And certainly we have ways for customers and prospects to request information through the websites. My direct contact information by email is k.oco.
Thank you for listening tonight.
N-N-O-R
All of our guests are invited because they offer actual.
Sorry about that. I hit the wrong button.
That's okay.
Kevin, say it again.
Yep. Again, I'm not sure we got cut off, but I got our website, www.neopostusa.com. We also have a dedicated shipping website, www.neopostshippingsolutions.com. And my personal contact information by email is k.oconnor@neopost.com.
Well, Kevin, I think your people are going to be very busy from today onward. So I'm not going to keep you much longer except to say thank you for coming and opening my eyes, if nobody else's, to the possibilities of saving money shipping. Thank you.
Don, thank you so much for the time. And again, like you mentioned, this is a busy time of the year. Just make sure you educate yourself. Take advantage of a lot of the shipping solutions offered to make this a very productive and beneficial shipping season for small businesses. Thanks again, Don.
No, thank you. Have a good day.
You too.
Thank you for listening tonight. All of our guests are invited because they offer actionable advice to our audience. They do not pay to join us, but rather demonstrate their capacity for helping our audience add profits. Thank you for listening, and we'll be here again next week with other experts to talk about ways to improve your profits.